now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. News from overnight as Russia ramping up its attacks in the region of Bakhmut. And we'll be talking more about that with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer this morning. The U.S. announcing another $400 million aid package. And this time they will be including much needed artillery shells. So that is something we'll be discussing later on in detail with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. The news story that's somewhat riveted the country throughout the week and throughout the past several months has been the Alex Murdaugh trial in Walterboro, South Carolina. As you know by now, he was convicted of murder. Two counts. We'll get into that very shortly. CPAC continues today, the final day of the Conservative Political Action Conference, and that, of course, taking place at National Harbor. Among the highlights today, former President Trump will be speaking late this afternoon, and also the straw poll will take place at CPAC today. And we'll go live to CPAC with KT McFarland later on this morning. And we've got some of the better audio highlights of CPAC coming up in the next couple of minutes, so stick around with us for that. And I want to start with the Alex Murdaugh verdict. It all came down within a three-hour deliberation after months of coverage by the national and international news. It only took the jury 3 hours to return a verdict, and one of the jurors said, well, we only spent about 45 minutes to figure out that verdict, but the process took 3 hours. It was rather riveting if you were paying attention to it yesterday when Alex Murdaugh was given the opportunity to speak before his sentencing. Here's what he had to say to the judge and the court.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm innocent. I would never hurt my wife, Maggie, and I would never hurt my son, Pawpaw.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Anything further?
I don't think further comment is necessary, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And he had a second opportunity in that hearing yesterday to make comment, and here's the second statement from Alex Murdaugh.
And I tell you again, I respect this court, but I'm innocent. I would never, under any circumstances, hurt my wife, Maggie, and I would never, under any circumstances, hurt my son, Pawpaw.
Well, and it might not have been you. It might have been the monster you become when you take 15, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 opioid pills. Maybe you become another person. I've seen that before. The person standing before me was not the person who committed the crime, though it's the same individual. We'll leave that at that.
Judge Clifton Newman speaking there, and the judge had a further comment about the evidence.
All of the evidence pointed to only one conclusion. That's the conclusion that you all reached.
Alan Wilson is the South Carolina Attorney General.
What a great day for the people of South Carolina. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except for every other kind. I kind of want to adopt that and say we may have the worst criminal justice system in the world, but it's better than every other kind that there is. And our criminal justice system worked tonight. It gave a voice to Maggie and Paul Murdaugh. I want to say tonight, their voice was heard tonight, and justice was brought for them. We can't bring them back, but we can bring them justice.
No, he's not running for higher office. No, not at all. Let's turn to CPAC. By the way, we're going to spend quite a bit of time with Jim Trusty really analyzing the entire Alex Murdaugh saga, the defense, the strategy. We'll talk to him about the judge. We'll talk to him about the possibility of an appeal. And we'll spend some time with Jim Trusty on that Alex Murdaugh case coming up later on in this hour. So we turn to CPAC. And as you probably have heard by now, Ron DeSantis did not attend CPAC. Mike Pence did not attend CPAC, so two of the key potential presidential candidates were not there. However, Nikki Haley was there. Former President Trump will be speaking later on today. And Nikki Haley had some, I thought, striking comments, and a lot of people have said she's running for vice president. I'm not so sure I would limit her to vice president because she is quite talented. As you listen to Nikki Haley, you can envision her either in a presidential debate or envision her if, as people say, she's running for vice president. Just envision Nikki Haley in a vice presidential debate with Kamala Harris. And this is Nikki Haley yesterday at CPAC.
We need families who are thriving and confident. But liberals have given them the highest inflation in 40 years and the lowest confidence in history. And we need our military to be stronger than ever. But what does Joe Biden have our troops doing? Taking gender pronoun classes. Now, I'm the wife of a combat veteran, and that disgusts me. Our troops already know the difference between men and women. They also know that we need a different commander-in-chief.
And she continued in that same narrative.
It's not just our military. On Biden and Harris's watch, this woke self-loathing has swept our country. It's in the classroom, the boardroom, and the back rooms of government. We're told our country is flawed, rotten, and full of hate. Joe and Kamala even say that America's racist. Wokeness is a virus more dangerous than any pandemic, hands down. I have traveled the world and back, and I've seen what's out there. America isn't perfect, but the principles at the heart of America are perfect. And take it from me, the first minority female governor in history, America is not a racist country.
And we have just one more brief clip from Nikki Haley at CPAC.
In my administration, police and Border Patrol will know that we have their backs. And criminals and illegal immigrants will know that we have their number.
So that's a little bit of the presidential race of 2024 already from Nikki Haley at CPAC. Now, as you know, if you listen to the program, I often will use select quotes from Senator John Kennedy, because he's a Republican from Louisiana. And I do that because he's got a way of just sort of cutting through all of the clutter, cutting through all of the muck, and telling it like it is. And Senator Kennedy had him going at CPAC.
Sometimes my friends will ask me, they say, Kennedy, how do you sleep at night? How do you sleep at night knowing that some people don't like you? And I tell them, with the fan on.
He's an interesting guy, and he has had no mercy on the President of the United States, Joe Biden.
President Biden has been spectacularly awful. If you put President Biden in charge of the Sahara Desert, he would run out of sand. If the aliens landed in Washington, D.C. tomorrow and said, take me to your leader, it would be embarrassing.
That's Senator Kennedy at CPAC, and a very interesting guy. So I want to turn to some answers to questions that we've all been asking for a while about the FBI. We'll do that next, but let's head to the WMAL Traffic Center.
Still have the serious crash in Rockville, Montrose Road, just east of I-270. The accident actually between Tower Oaks Boulevard and Tildenwood Drive. All lanes blocked in both directions, as well as the off-ramp as well. No issues on I-270 itself. The Beltway moving well. The outer loop as you approach Connecticut Avenue, that earlier crash gone. Beltway, or 95 in the Parkway between the Beltways looking good. Into Virginia, no reported issues along Interstate 66, 395 and 95 all moving well. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Wind gusts up to 45, 50 miles per hour by this afternoon. Wind advisory does stay in effect throughout today. Temperatures, however, a little bit better, upper 50s to near 60 degrees, and a little bit more sunshine toward the afternoon. Tonight, temperatures falling into the upper 30s, and tomorrow, lighter winds and higher temperatures, near 60 for your Sunday afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital. We're at 620 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. We've all been hearing the Democratic narrative that crime is down and there's not a crime problem in this country, yada, yada, yada. Well, the director of the FBI contradicted some of that Democratic narrative. He was on this week with Brett Baer at the Fox News Channel. And these are questions that I think a lot of us have been asking of the FBI and of the FBI leadership. And I had a couple here that I just wanted to present because it puts a different light on some of the things we've been hearing. And we're going to go to Christopher Wray, and he's talking with Brett Baer about crime.
You mentioned violent crime. Is it ticking up, and have you seen that post-COVID?
I would say violent crime for the last few years has been at an alarmingly high level, and I talk with police chiefs and sheriffs pretty much every week from all 50 states, and every single one of them will tell you that violent crime is the number one issue on their list, and we're working hard with them. You know, this past summer, the FBI, working with our partners, was arresting 55 violent criminals per day, single day, 55 a day, and that gives you a measure of what we're dealing with, and it's all over the country. I think we arrested 20,000 violent criminals and child predators last year, so it's something we're trying to do our part, but our close partners in state and local law enforcement have a heck of a challenge on their hands.
Well, that's not a narrative that you hear from the Democrats very often now, is it? Not that he's a Democrat. He was asked about threats, and I thought this was somewhat interesting.
Well, you're monitoring things. What is the biggest threat that you think you all see?
Well, you know, the thing that jumps out to me, Brett, having been, and I was actually in this facility on 9/11 itself, in this hallway, and in a lot of the rooms around here, what's different about the time frame that we're in right now is that every threat is elevated at the same time. So both domestic terrorism and foreign terrorism, hostile nation states, China, of course, Russia, Iran, violent crime is through the roof, child exploitation during the pandemic kind of went up significantly, human trafficking, cyber attacks are at a whole new level. So what really distinguishes so much of what's going on today is not any one threat specifically, but the fact that they're all hitting that level kind of all at the same time. We're involved with all of them.
And there's one other one I wanted to get to from Christopher Wray, and a lot of questions about the Hunter Biden investigation, and Brett Baer asked him about that.
Why is this investigation on the Hunter Biden laptops taking so long?
Well, the investigation is being led, as you may know, by a U.S. attorney appointed in the last administration out of Delaware, and the FBI is actively supporting and working with that U.S. attorney on that investigation.
But the whistleblowers are telling these lawmakers that there was an internal effort to shut down the investigation from the beginning. Have you found that?
I have not found anything like that.
That's the latest from Christopher Wray this week with Brett Baer. I thought that was very interesting. Chicago this week, you may have heard that Mayor Lori Lightfoot was the first mayor to lose an election in 40 years in Chicago. She blamed it on the fact she's a woman, and she blamed it on racism. And that was, of course, the blame that we hear a lot. But maybe the blame is the following. From the Chicago Police Department, these are the stats. Murder up 59%, shootings up 43%, robbery up 27%, vehicle theft up 270% in Chicago over her reign. And She wondered why she didn't get reelected. And you may have seen the uproar from the Democrats where President Biden is siding actually with Republicans on not letting the D.C. City Council soften the crime enforcement in Washington. Why? D.C., first 3 months of this year, 36% increase in homicides, 111% motor vehicle theft. That's 111%, not 11%, and 25% in all crime up in D.C. first 3 months of 2023, those stats from the Metropolitan Police Department. And then they wonder why the president is siding with Republicans. 626, this is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Jennifer Harper coming up. We'll talk with Jim Trusty, John Gizzi at Newsmax, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland at CPAC. Stay with us. . 629 Saturday Morning Update. Mike Bronciotti is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Montrose Road closed in both directions, east of I-270. The accident between Tower Oaks Boulevard and Tilden-Wood Drive. As I said, all lanes blocked in both directions. I-270 itself looking good. No issues on the Beltway in Maryland. Between the Beltways 95 and the Parkway moving well. No problems along Route 50 at this time. Going into Virginia, Beltway traffic moving just fine. Interstate 66 from Haymarket to the Roslyn Tunnel looking good at this time. No issues on 95. The main lines moving well between Springfield and Fredericksburg. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Wind gusts up to 45, 50 miles per hour by this afternoon. Wind advisory does stay in effect throughout today. Temperatures, however, a little bit better. Upper 50s to near 60 degrees and a little bit more sunshine for the afternoon. Tonight, temperatures falling into the upper 30s. And tomorrow, lighter winds and higher temperatures near 60 for your Sunday afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:30 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9.
WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
We continue on the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is with us each weekend. She is the author of Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
We often talk a lot about the polls, how the president is doing, and how the former president now is doing against the current president, because there's a chance we'll see the two of them head-to-head again in 2024. So what's the latest on the numbers?
Yeah, boy, it gets complicated with all the numbers, but they're always interesting, Rick. And I have a, first we'll open with kind of an uncomfortable but sort of a necessary question. One of our pollsters, this would be Yahoo News, they asked people if they felt President Biden was too old to hold office. That was quite the bold question. But anyway, here we go. If you do all the math, if he was reelected in 2024, he would be 82 at the start of his second term and 86 by the time it concluded. So let's move on to the numbers here. According to Yahoo News and a YouGov poll, 7 in 10 registered voters, that would be 68%, now say that President Biden is too old for another term. That's the exact quote that they used. Again, this is according to Yahoo News. And more Democrats, that's 48%, agree with that than would disagree. Oh, 34% would agree with that. And among Republicans, of course, 85% say Mr. Biden is too old, along with 71% of independents. And 87% of those who voted for Donald Trump in 2020. And, you know, let's ask about Mr. Trump. Is he too old? Because the polls certainly address that. And so speaking of the former president, is he too old to vie for the White House? The poll found that 45% of voters overall agree that Mr. Trump, who would be 78 at the start of his second term, was too old for that role. And that includes 32% of Republicans, 46% of independents, and 58% of Democrats. Another funny finding here, 68% of the respondents in this poll also favored mandatory mental competency tests for politicians who are over 75 years old. And just a couple more numbers here. I know it's early in the morning, but these are sort of interesting. 51% of U.S. adults say that President Biden would be a weaker candidate in the 2024 presidential election than he was in 2020, and only 20% felt that he was going to be stronger. So again, this is a Yahoo News survey, and we'll throw in one more thing about Trump. Oh, all the polls this morning, but this is an Emerson College poll, and Mr. Trump has an edge on Mr. Biden at the moment. This is what Emerson College had to say. Despite increased support within the Democratic Party, President Biden trails former President Trump in a hypothetical 2024 presidential matchup, 42% to 46%. 7% would support someone else, and 5% are undecided. So that's your myriad numbers for this morning.
Today is the final day for the Conservative Political Action Conference, better known as CPAC, here in town for the first time in several years. And what do you see as the highlights so far and what to expect for the rest of the day?
Well, certainly CPAC is always gets interesting press from a lot of Democratic-oriented news organizations, but I like to look at the history of CPAC sometimes. A lot of people don't know that the very first CPAC took place in 1974, and the inaugural keynote speaker at that event was none other than Ronald Reagan, and the future president, he gave his very now famous A Shining City Upon the Hill speech. If you don't know about that, you might want to look it up. It's a great speech, but that's what happened. And now let's look at what's going on or what has gone on since Thursday. CPAC hosted a total of 114 very well-known and very well-qualified speakers, and you can certainly look that up online if you missed that or didn't get out there, how many folks were there. U.S. senators, representatives, governors, diplomats, activists, commentators, broadcasters, podcasters, journalists, former government officials, et cetera. And I looked up a lot of the just the titles of all the topics that were discussed over these days. Here's just a couple of them. Congress learns the art of the deal, sacking the woke playbook, open borders kill, caging the red dragon, begging for oil, finish the wall and build the dome, and one more, the new axis of evil. A lot of interesting stuff going on there. And if you're curious, former President Donald Trump is going to give a very much anticipated speech before a very friendly audience today, and you can. That'll be at 5:25 p.m. on the dot. And if you want to take a peek at that, the live video feed can be found at cpac.org. It's very much easily found on the page under events. So that's what's going on at CPAC.
One of the major players who is not at CPAC is the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, and he is out on a book tour this week. Tell us a little bit about the book and what that means.
Yeah, indeed. He's been a very busy gentleman, and he does have a new book out there. And the title kind of tells all where he's coming from right now. The title of this book is called The Courage to Be Free, Florida's Blueprint for America's Revival. Now, that pretty well sounds presidential to me. Anyway, before it was even issued, the day it arrived, it was number one on the Amazon bestseller list. That's how many people picked up this book. And according to the publisher, that is Broadside Books. They say this book is a winning blueprint for patriots across the country, and it is a rallying cry for every American who wishes to preserve our liberties. But Mr. DeSantis already has a very dynamic new video out there about that, and he's referring to Florida as kind of, again, a blueprint for everybody else. And he says that Florida was a refuge for sanity, a citadel of freedom for fellow Americans, and even for people around the world. Very interesting there. And certainly the book deserves a look-see, because if he is referring to this as a blueprint for what his campaign is going to be, well, we can all find out what that is. And again, according to Mr. DeSantis, Florida is proof positive that we the people are not destined for failure. Florida is leading the nation. We are the nation's fastest growing state. We rank number one in educational freedom. This is a record we can all be proud of. And he also closes that out by saying, decline is a choice, success is attainable, and freedom is worth fighting for. Again, that's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
There's a lot of attention paid to careers for veterans once they're out of the service. And here's an area that I think that would be a very good career path for not only the veterans, but for our country. And you wrote about it this week.
Yes, I did. I completely agree with what you're saying. We're talking about military veterans going into journalism. Now, that's an interesting idea because of their perspective and experiences. And actually, there is a nonprofit organization called Military Veterans in Journalism. And they have announced that they have paired up with McClatchy. Now, McClatchy is a very sizable news organization. They have 65 million readers around the country. They focus on local journalism. And they have stepped up to provide 5 military veteran journalists or military vets who want to be journalists, with paid fellowships. This would place them in McClatchy's local newsroom. They said this is an opportunity for veterans who are up-and-coming journalists to receive 6 months of paid journalistic employment in their own communities. Great idea. And they say, additionally, these added positions will help solve reporting coverage problems at a local level. And again, this is coming from Military Veterans in Journalism and McClatchy, the news organization. And if you are curious, if you know someone who might be interested, if you are a military vet yourself, easiest stop would go over to Military Veterans of Journalism, and that is mvj.network. So something to look into and a great idea on the part of both organizations.
You always write about very interesting real estate opportunities, and got one close to home this week.
I do, and that's why I want to talk about it this morning. There's an island for sale on Chesapeake Bay. This is a 5-acre island. It's called Tippity-Witchity Island. It's actually in St. Mary's County. It includes a charming and spacious 3-bedroom home with river and bay views, 2 baths, a great room with wood-burning fireplace, ample windows, screen gazebo, gardens and private porches. This includes a dock with a boat lift, oh yay, also a heated in-ground swimming pool, walking trails, lush grounds. It is available for the first time in 50 years. Not exactly cheap. This is priced at $2.1 million. That's through South Beach. And if you're curious, even to take an armchair tour, pretty neat site. This is just TippityWitchityIsland.com. Interesting, again, armchair travel.
$2.1 million for your own island on the Chesapeake Bay. That's not a bad deal. You can spend $2 million bucks in Northwest D.C. for just another average house.
That's right.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, The Washington Times, as always, thank you very much.
Have a good weekend, everybody. Thank you.
6:41 on the Saturday Morning Update. We'll talk to Jim Trustee next, take an in-depth look at the Alex Murdaugh trial, which came to a close the end of the week. But right now, we'll head over to the WMAL Traffic Center, and Mike Bronciotti is there this morning.
Still have the accident working in Rockville, just east of I-270 along Montrose Road. All lanes blocked in both directions there. No problems on the Beltway at this time. And traveling between the Beltways, take your pick. Both the Parkway, Interstate 95 moving well. And no reports of any problems on the John Hanson Highway, Route 50 from the Capitol Beltway to the Bay Bridge. Looking good on the Beltway in the Commonwealth, Interstate 66. The main lines of I-395 and Interstate 95 as far south as Fredericksburg moving smoothly. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Wind gusts up to 45, 50 miles per hour by this afternoon. Wind advisory does stay in effect throughout today. Temperatures, however, a little bit better, upper 50s to near 60 degrees, and a little bit more sunshine for the afternoon. Tonight, temperatures falling into the upper 30s, and tomorrow, lighter winds and higher temperatures, near 60 for your Sunday afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:42, the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trustee joins us. He is a member of the Trump legal team, a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Jim, the Alex Murdaugh trial. We've been talking about it for over a year. It came to a close in like a three-hour jury deliberation, sentencing on Friday. First off, a summary of the charges and the verdict.
Well, the charges, the heavy charges that were in play here were first-degree murder charges of Maggie and Paul, the wife and son of a very troubled and very famous, or at least locally famous and now nationally infamous, attorney by the name of Alex Murdaugh.
After the Murdaugh testimony last week, you had suggested that we'd be looking at either a conviction or possibly a hung jury. When you saw the jury deliberations so short, I mean like 3 hours, one of the jurors who was interviewed on Good Morning America said it took like 45 minutes for them to make the decision. How did that strike you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When you talk about 3 hours for a verdict, I think when I was a prosecutor, I'd say, well, that's barely polite. You know, like they got to know each other. They passed out the notepads and they started drawing nooses because they knew where they were going on this thing. So that's a very quick verdict. But, you know, coming into it, the point I was trying to make when I talked about it either being a hung jury or a conviction was that the severity of the crime, even in the class of murders, this is, you know, on the upper level of just depraved, of horrible. You know, killing family members, shooting a son point blank, basically with a shotgun in the head. And they're, you know, they're kind of unthinkable crimes. And what that told me, particularly as the circumstantial case came together, as you heard that the suspect had created an alibi that was demonstratively false, all of that basically told me that this jury would never be comfortable with all 12 of them saying there's a reasonable doubt. You know, it was just, it's kind of the combination of good circumstantial evidence, but also the notion that this is such a horrible crime. I mean, there's really a very innate part of human beings where, you know, they're willing to kind of suspend judgment when the stakes aren't as high. You know, if you had a DUI case, Rick, somebody's driving drunk, no accident, no breath test, sounds like they might have gone and had a few drinks. But, you know, the jury can hear that trial and say, well, we know he spent a lot of money on his lawyer. We know he lost his license for a while. There's no breath test. You know, if they acquit on that case, they're not going home and worrying on some deep moral level that they did something wrong. But when you talk about a double murder, a horrific murder like this, I think most human beings, whether they're conscious of it or not, they really gravitate towards wanting to avenge it or at least have some sense of justice. And it makes it hard to walk away from a case that's fairly or is very strong. And I think that's a dynamic here. And it also kind of explains the quick verdict. They were in a long circumstantial trial. They heard a lot of evidence, a lot of argument. I think they probably took it very, very seriously. And when I heard that they were back with a verdict, I thought, well, there goes the hung jury. You know, this is going to be a conviction. And I'm sure I wasn't alone in that assessment. And that's what happened.
A lot of Monday morning quarterbacking about his decision to testify. And he's an attorney and a prominent attorney. And in fact, the judge said that they had to remove the picture of his grandfather that was hanging on the wall at the courthouse because he was afraid it would prejudice the trial. So here's a smart attorney decides to testify. What do you say Monday morning?
Well, I don't totally join the chorus on this one. And I will say there's an awful lot of them that waited for the verdict to announce how sure they were that it was a bad idea for him to testify. That's pretty convenient. The portrait stuff's hilarious. I mean, this is an iconic family. I mean, it really is like watching a Dallas episode or something where, you know, there's just incredible drama, incredible stories of sociopathic tendencies going through that family. But the bottom line really is, the government did, I think, a very good job of not just puncturing the alibi that Alex tried to create, but showing it was a false alibi. You know, and there's a difference. You can knock down an alibi and have the jury think, oh, that's probably not really a legit alibi. But this was basically convincing the jury that he had manufactured a big lie to cover up the murders. And that's, you know, it's a degree of severity that kind of makes the case stronger. I think there's probably a couple of factors that went into him testifying. One is that, you know, this is so powerful, you pretty much have to get up on the stand and come up with an explanation for why you created that elaborate lie about your whereabouts. And he tried that when he talked about opiate addiction. It didn't exactly hang together, but it was something. The second part that I think guides it is remembering who this guy is. I mean, by definition at this point almost, you could say he is a sociopathic, probably quite charming, experienced attorney. I know that sounds redundant to some of your listeners, but, you know, the reality is he probably told his lawyers, I'm going to take the stand. I have things to say. I'm a credible, believable witness, and probably believed that in his heart. So there may have been a little bit of reaction to how strong the case was coming in from the government. It would not surprise me at all, and we'll never know this because of attorney-client privilege, that Alex was his own worst enemy, thinking he could just charm his fellow South Carolinians by his tears and by his words on the witness stand.
So Murdaugh's attorneys held a press conference after the verdict and the sentencing on Friday. One of the things they brought up was the introduction of financial crimes into this trial, and the punditry, of course, saying that could be a strong grounds for appeal. How did that strike you when they did enter a different crime into this case?
Yeah, I mean, it's always an issue on appeal, and different states have different, I guess, thresholds for how seriously they take that issue. I think the problem the Murdaugh attorneys are going to run into here is that the basis for presenting this information was to say this is the motive for the murder. It wasn't to say he's just a really crappy guy and he does bad things everywhere. You know, that would be a problem. And the confusion, you know, the ability of a jury to understand why it's being presented is kind of important here. So the judge, if you'll remember, actually had testimony from a number of these witnesses out of the presence of the jury to kind of assess, to balance whether or not this would make the case confusing, whether it was convincing, whether it was helpful, whether it was just prejudicial. In other words, it made Murdaugh look bad for no other reason. And the judge used his discretion to allow it in after doing that, what they call in-camera review. So I actually think there's a decent chance it'll be a part of a brief, to be sure. It'll be appealed. But I think that the unusual facts of this case, the fact that it was the government's theory of motivation here, pretty good chance it'll hold up on appeal.
So he being a bright lawyer and obviously surrounded with bright attorneys, the circumstantial evidence here, I mean, is that harder to prove, obviously, a conviction, but it seemed to be enough in this case?
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of just kind of common parlance, you'll hear people say, oh, all they have is a circumstantial case. And as if, you know, direct cases where you have direct testimony from eyewitnesses is always more powerful. I mean, I guess if you're a prosecutor, the dream is both. You know, you want to have good circumstances and direct testimony. Well, this was a circumstantial case. There weren't people that came forward that said, I saw the shots fired, I saw Alex do it, that kind of thing. And they built, you know, painstakingly a whole bunch of different circumstances, the false alibi, his access to firearms, the falsehood of his reaction, you know, a million little pieces in a puzzle. And it's a reminder, you know, the law basically says, and they usually have instructions that go to the jury at closing argument, that say the law draws no distinction between circumstantial and direct evidence. And this is one of those reminders. You know, sometimes direct testimony isn't as great as you might think. Witnesses sound shaky. They don't have complete observations. They lose some of the details of their memory by the time the case goes to trial. This was a circumstantial case, but sometimes that's really very comforting for a jury where they say, I see the puzzle. I see the picture that all these pieces are putting in front of me, and it's not really relying on any individual's credibility. It's relying on, you know, common sense assessment of a variety of little facts that show a big picture.
Did the fact it was circumstantial evidence have any role in why it was not a death penalty case?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know that we have a real straight answer from anybody. You know, there was a question publicly why it wasn't a death penalty case. And that was actually decided by the prosecutors fairly close to the beginning of the trial, you know, kind of surprisingly close to the beginning of trial. And what they said was it was the cost and complexity of a death penalty case, the uncertain legal state of executions in South Carolina, and the lengthier trial required in death penalty cases. Well, those are kind of stock responses, frankly. I mean, of course a death penalty case is going to be longer by definition. Of course, there's going to be a little more complexity. I've tried some death penalty cases as a prosecutor, I guess probably about four of them, and they are more expensive. There's more expert witnesses. There's a whole penalty phase that you don't normally have in a non-death penalty case. The uncertain legal state of executions in South Carolina is kind of an interesting rabbit hole, Rick. The South Carolina General Assembly in 2021 brought back the electric chair to South Carolina. And, you know, it had been on the books for South Carolina for more than a century, and they made that the default method of execution instead of lethal injection. I'm actually kind of surprised. I don't remember hearing that and wondering, you know, what was, I hate to say sparking such an idea, but what motivated the General Assembly to go with the electric chair. And there was a time in the early or mid-90s through 2009, South Carolina was actually carrying out about three executions a year, but that dried up in about 2011. And so I wouldn't say any of this makes the legal state of executions uncertain. It just shows that it's slowed down in recent years, but it's still on the books. It's still available. And South Carolina was going to pursue the death penalty against Dylan Roof, the Charleston Church massacre defendant, who was sentenced to death on the federal case that was filed simultaneously. So I actually think that the circumstantial case question is a really good question in this context, Rick, because I think they looked at it and they said, you know, this is one of these death penalty eligible cases where it might suffer from a phenomenon called residual doubt. And what residual doubt is a jury says, you know, we've been picked here to do a death penalty case. We've heard all the evidence on guilt and we're going to convict. We find that he's guilty. But even though we believe it's beyond a reasonable doubt, we have a little lingering or residual doubt in our heads about whether we got the right guy, and so we will not execute. And so that's a strange phenomenon you see in death penalty litigation, where a jury that's been qualified to mete out the death penalty has just a little bit of doubt left over from the guilt phase that infects the process, where they basically compromise and say, well, we're going to convict him, but we're not going to go as far as executing. I mean, I think that phenomena might be a better explanation in a circumstantial case than the notion that somehow it's going to be too expensive to add a week or two to the trial.
I mentioned the juror that appeared on Good Morning America. What struck you about what he had to say about the case and the deliberations?
Well, it actually really touches a nerve for me, you know, and it's not even what he says. I mean, he said some things that were kind of goofy, you know, describing the process, and we all knew in 45 minutes. And I think the thing that stood out was him saying, I don't think those were tears. I was looking right at him. He's just blowing snot. You know, it's an interesting perspective. But the phenomena of celebrity jurors, of jurors going on TV or grand jurors in Georgia going on TV tours, is outrageous to me. And I really think it's a very damaging phenomena. You know, I know that jury deliberations might be a little bit like the sausage factory, where you don't really want to know what they do when they come up with the product. But the deliberation is supposed to be sacred. You know, it's supposed to be a time where 12 people exchange deeply held thoughts and questions and resolve issues. And they shouldn't have to worry that some juror from that conversation is going to go run out on TV and try to make a name for themselves. And so, you know, I'd like to see actually laws in the states that prohibit it. And, you know, kind of like the Son of Sam law prohibited a murderer from profiting from a book. You know, if they're not going to have the good grace to avoid doing it without some sort of rule, then let's create a rule, because this is a damaging phenomenon. It's not good for the system for these folks to come out and give their kind of self-serving, one-sided, look-at-me approach to what happened in the jury room. And I'll add this. If I'm a defense attorney on that case and I've got a juror running his mouth about what they did in the room, it's going to make its way into a motion. I'm going to find a way. I'm going to at least research the law, but probably find a way to file some sort of motion second-guessing the verdict and the deliberation process because of what this guy has done. So it doesn't mean it's going to win, but, you know, why risk the issue of undoing this conviction on a difficult case by having your 15 minutes of fame on TV as a juror? So I think it's a really a horrific moment for the system. It really touched my nerve when the Fulton County foreperson from the grand jury had so much to say, but this is another bad moment. And hopefully somebody in positions of authority at legislatures will give it attention and try to stop it from happening.
Or at least delay it. I mean, if they waited 90 days or, you know, they had like an embargo for 6 months, the media, you know, that's old news by then. I mean, who wants to hear about the Murdaugh case in 6 months, you know?
Right. That's a great idea. Even a year or something. Let it get through the appellate process before you start mucking around and telling secrets. But I just think the principle is bad for the system, whether or not it leads to some sort of appeal. It's just not a phenomenon that we should want, because it's going to attract people to be on juries that have their own motivations, not to sit there and decipher the truth and mete out justice, but to get on Oprah. And I'm not a fan of that phenomenon at all.
Jim Trustee, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Thank you for the insight. Much appreciated.
Sure thing. Have a good weekend.
And you too. It is 6:58 on the Saturday morning update, and we've been talking a lot about CPAC this morning, but one of the key players not at CPAC is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He's released a book. He's out on a book tour this week. That book tour took him to the Fox News studios. He talked to Brett Baer. And this is one interesting question about the Trump endorsement that he had received in the past.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think our voters always make their own decisions. And they consider, obviously, endorsements. And at that time when he was president, his was the big enchilada. But our voters want to look at you and size you up. And they take this the responsibility very, very seriously. But when I wrote that in the book about the consequential, the fact is there was a big difference between me and my Democrat opponent 2018. I mean, you couldn't probably have been any different.
So that'll be a very interesting couple of years as we see how the dynamics play out between Ron DeSantis and former President Trump. Quick note, Supreme Court, we'll talk about that a little later on, the situation with Liz Warren conflicting with Nancy Pelosi and their views of the president's abilities to actually release that student loan debt. So we'll get into that a little bit later on. We got the news coming up next at 7. John Gizzi's on the way right after that. And we've got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, Cheryl Atkinson, and KT McFarland all coming up on the Saturday morning update.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.